Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Even where you think hip hop is today, like what the 15-year-olds are rapping about, is not Nickelodeon friendly.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 245, a talk with Nick Cannon. Nick, as you undoubtedly already know, is a musician, actor, comedian, TV executive, and all-around entertainer. Nick got his start doing stand-up comedy while still a teenager. He parlayed that into work at Nickelodeon, where he wrote for and starred in now-classic shows like All That, Kenan and Kel, and the appropriately named Nick Cannon Show. He moved from that into starring in movies like Drumline and Love Don't Cost a Thing, putting out several stand-up specials, and even hosting America's Got Talent. But, as you'll hear, Nick has always thought of himself as a musician first. He has released numerous albums and mixtapes, written and produced for other artists, and has worked with everyone from Biz Markie to Gucci Mane to the Neptunes to Kanye West. And, of course, he combined his loves of hip-hop and improv comedy into the long-running hit TV show Wildin' Out. Nick's latest musical project, released earlier this year, is Calling All Models, the mixtape. I caught up with Nick Cannon at his office at Nickelodeon, where he is the chairman of Teen Nick. While you're listening, head over to thecyphershow.com to check out show notes, playlists, and our archives. When you're done with this episode, you might want to listen to our interview with another rapper who knows a thing or two about hosting events, Destroy of the Arsonists, along with his groupmate Q-Unique. Also, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future shows. Now is a good time to remind you that the best thing you can do to support us is head over to patreon.com/thecyphershow and throw us a few bucks. We spend a ton of time working on the show each week, and those donations really help us to keep it sustainable. Which is worth more, the cypher or that overpriced latte? And now, here's Nick Cannon like you've never heard him before. You've done so much, man. And I wanted to start, you know, somewhere towards the beginning.
Wow.
Which was like some crazy, crazy shit. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the very first song you released, which was the Will Smith cover, the Jazzy Jeff cover.
Underdig the situation. Mom's bounced out for a week's vacation. And she left the keys to the 500. Was she mine? Why she gonna know? I just did a Benz a little spin.
Shit, you're 19, 20 years old, and you get a Teddy Riley remix.
I just get a Benz a little spin. See what it look like with 20-inch rims. Then I'd be the man in my neighborhood. Well, maybe I shouldn't. Yeah, of course I should. You're paying attention because the plot gets hot. Yo,
What was that like when you found out that was going
to
happen?
You know what? It's so weird, man. Like, to talk about my music, especially that early on, it's probably one of the most frustrating things for me in the world. Just because that was definitely during that time where I was a certain guy, but the machine wanted me to be another guy. Mm-hmm. Which now, as a full adult who understands the business, like, I get it. And I think I actually handled it pretty well during that time. But I wanted to be, and I had peers that were doing everything that I wanted to do. But I was being guided in a different direction because of a certain perception and a certain branding on me. So specifically, the Parents Just Don't Understand record, I've been doing music all my life. I play 7 music instruments. I produce. Even as a kid, I wanted to be more of a producer than even a rapper. I loved making beats. That was my thing all through high school, DJing. That's what I loved to do. And really, that entrepreneurial spirit, I wanted my own record label. I wanted to be Puffy, Jermaine Dupri. Like, I wanted to be those guys. I didn't want to be a rapper, but I was entertaining. I was a cute little kid who told jokes. And so through that process, I was making mixtapes and producing for other artists and doing all this stuff. And, you know, being on Nickelodeon and making a little bit of money, I got an opportunity. The cool thing is I actually created Nick Records. That was my concept for Nickelodeon. And we took it to Jive. And at the time, my man, Albie Hecht, who ran Nickelodeon, was like, yo, whatever you want to do musically, like, if you want to start a record label, let's do it.
Being the former president of Nickelodeon, Albie Hecht also founded Spike TV and produced films like the Rugrats movie, Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, and, to bring things full circle, Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, which featured on its soundtrack Nick, Lil Romeo, and 3LW performing Parents Just Don't Understand.
So I created Nick Records thinking like, oh wow, I got my own record label. And the first thing we do is on the Jimmy Neutron soundtrack. A remake of Parents Just Don't Understand.
And I've seen it. Yeah. By the way, a sort of censored version of that song, right?
How do you censor a clean song? Like, but that's it. So,
and to it's be fair, there's some creepy stuff in the original version of that song.
Yeah, very. There's some underage.
Almost had a heart attack that day. Come to find out the girl was a 12-year-old runaway. I was arrested. The car was impounded. There was no way for me to avoid being grounded.
But. The funny thing is I had already been signed to Will Smith for, what, at that time, maybe 3 years.
Oh, so the Will Smith stuff predates that cover. I wasn't sure what the timeline on that was.
And I remember going to Will, and Will Gate taught me the game, like the real industry, and would tell me, like, yo, if you want to be taken seriously, you got to do this, and put me with everybody from Jeff to Biz Markie to all of these people that were hip-hop icons and said, this is how the game works. And I asked him, should I do this? They're, you know, the movie company and Nickelodeon are asking me to do a remake of Parents Just Don't Understand. He said, absolutely not. And I was like, I know. I was like, why would I? I was like, he's like, from what you're trying to do, he's like, one, you're way more talented than that. And not, you know, the people on the song, all of those are my friends. 3LW, Lil Romeo is like, yo, but you're not them. Like, you're a unique artist. Like, and I was like, all right, well, I can't, because at the time, you know, I just started, the record label, this is the first, I'm putting out a music sound, and it did fairly well. But for me as an artist, it wasn't a great, you don't debut with something like that. And so I tried to finagle. I was like, all right, well, let me produce. If I produce the beat, make it a little more edgy and kind of so, and, you know, they let me do that. And the way they trumped me was with Teddy Riley, because they knew that I would never say no. They knew I was going to pick Teddy over myself any day. I wouldn't argue when they're like, and because, you know, Teddy Riley is one of the greatest
one of my favorite producers. Right.
And Teddy was like, yo, I'll do that check out. Because I was trying to go a little more urban, a little as pop. And they knew clearly that wasn't the agenda. They were selling a kids movie. They needed a kid friendly song. And they were trying to recreate what they did with the Rugrats song with Blackstreet and Maya and Mace that they had did with the Rugrats movie a couple years prior.
Chunky get scared, Chunky said let's go. If I was a Rugrat, it would have been surreal. Me and my twin would have been just like Phil and Lil.
With one wish.
That was the idea behind it. And again, I kicked myself. Like, I have no regrets whatsoever, but I just wish I would have knew how to be my own artist as a teenager, because it was inside of me. Mm-hmm. It was what I really wanted, but I just listened and obeyed at the time instead of rebelling, which my nature would soon let out.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Since we're in the offices of Nickelodeon, like, you know,
it worked out at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But, 20 years in.
Yeah. The thing about it is you were in all that, all of the first Nickelodeon shows you did.
Stop, look and watch. Ready yet? Get set. It's all that.
All That was a sketch comedy show that ran on Nickelodeon from 1994 until 2005. Nick was a staff writer and cast member on the show from 1997 until 2000, and also worked on its spin-offs, Kenan and Kel, on the appropriately titled The Nick Cannon Show.
You were older than your castmates.
Yeah, it's funny. People,
I mean, it's, you know, 4 years, 3 years, whatever it was.
People didn't think so because I looked so young.
Yeah.
And, you know, only people I really wasn't older than was like Kenan and Kel and Josh Server. And they were kind of like the alumni.
Here it goes.
Kenan Thompson is, of course, the longest-tenured cast member in Saturday Night Live history. His comedic partner, Kel Mitchell, went on to work extensively in TV and film. And Josh Server is the only All That cast member to remain through all six original seasons before the show took a hiatus in 2000.
And I was, you know, Kenan still to this day is like my big brother. Like, he let me, like, sleep on his couch when I used to have to drive up from San Diego and stuff. So he was more like someone I looked up to, but all the other people I was on show were, like, substantially younger than you.
You feel kind of isolated from them at the time?
I was just different, man. Like, I'm a kid from the projects. Like, that was like, you know, if I was rapping about shooting and pimping and stuff, but like, I knew how to play the game. So like, I, when it was time to be around them, I knew how to put on that character of the fun, likable 15-year-old when I was probably, you know, 19, you know. And I think, like you said, it's not that big of a difference when you think about it now, but even where you think hip hop is today, like what the 15-year-olds are rapping about, is not Nickelodeon friendly. But that's what I did well, and I knew how to be authentic, but at the same time, do my job. I knew how to, you know, stay true to my values, but give or be safe enough to give a great impression of like, oh, this is a good kid.
Yeah, and I think that came to fruition on your show, on the Nick Cannon show.
Which was
this very interesting balancing act.
Yeah, which was fun. You know, and it's funny because the way that all came about too was like, I was a writer. And, you know, I wrote a bunch of stuff for Kenan and Kel, a few other TV shows, doing warm-up, writing jokes. And then I wrote my own series that Will Smith bought for the WB.
The Loose Cannon.
Loose Cannon.
Yeah.
And
what was that, by the way, since it never got made and we'll never see
it? Yeah, I'm going to put that out one day. I'm going to put some clips out so people can see it because I actually still have the taste. It was a great show. But it honestly was The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but instead of Will, you had me. And instead of Bel-Air, it was a military school. So it was, you know, a 16-year-old kid going to military school, you know, was a knucklehead in his neighborhood, and that's kind of what the show was about. And it was great, you know, but, you know, the network had shifted directions during that time. Like, you know, I was supposed to come on, I was like a spinoff of the Jamie Foxx show and all of that stuff, and it rolled out differently. It didn't roll out the way that we wanted it to. The business, you know, and I learned. I mean, I was heartbroken as a kid. You know, I thought I was going to
have it's your one big chance, right?
Yeah, I was going to have my own show, and, you know, it hit hard, but I learned how to get tough really early. So then, you know, I went back to the drawing board and started writing more, and I happened to write and create my own show, and I thought that was interesting to be a 19-year-old kid who can produce and direct and write his own show. That's what we did, and I was like, I just want to do everything. I wanted to play characters.
My left, your right, it's some big old horses. They from Harlem. Those are the Harlem horses. They play ball.
I want to be man on the street.
Now you got your bling bling on, you got your money scarf, your glasses. How do you feel about your new outfit?
Oh, it's great. It's right off the rack.
You don't want to pull pranks, and like, this was like pre-Jackass. This was like, even pre-Tom Green, you know what I mean? Like, I was kind of like a kid that was doing those type of things, not to that level or extreme, because obviously it was Nickelodeon, but it was like shock comedy for the Nickelodeon.
There was the bit
audience.
When you pretended to arrest kids for picking up $20 off the street.
What were you going to do with that?
No.
We have an Andrew Jackson, guys.
Just have it on the ground.
What happened?
You want to know?
Who picked up the money off the ground?
Like, it was that. Like, I was dressing in drag.
This is where they shoot the show, y'all. Maybe I could be on this show. I could be the star of this show. Shoot, I could dance just like Tyena.
Going to movie premieres and drag. Like, I was doing, like, Sacha Baron Cohen stuff, like, as, you know, a 19-year-old.
Yeah, and here's the thing about that show is I, you know, rewatched a couple episodes to prepare for this. And
where did you watch those?
They're out there. You are so committed to every bit. Yeah. And it's kind of amazing. You never broke character. You never let it slip. Hey, it might be embarrassing to be wrestling a guy in a gorilla suit.
It was actually a bear costume.
Whatever it was you were doing at the time, yeah. you were fully... How did you develop that ability to kind of fully commit to a bit?
You know what? It's stand-up. You know what I mean? You know you got to commit. Like, the joke will never work unless you commit. And it's funny, still to this day, why I love acting so much is when I get to dive into a character, I disappear. And being someone who's always visible and always having to be me, there's the greatest joy in the world to me is being a character that's not me. And I love that. And I love that, you know, ever since I was a kid, ever since school plays, ever since, you know, being on stage, like, I love being a character. And I think some of the best master that, from Robin Williams to Eddie Murphy to, like, these are guys that they disappear in their characters.
When did you first realize stand-up comedy was a thing?
When I saw Eddie Murphy Raw and Delirious, and I learned every word to every joke, every bit, and would go to school and go to church and perform those bits.
You tried to pull them off as your own?
Yes. And, like, just to be able, like, that's what you would do.
Wait a second. Just to backtrack, you performed stuff from Raw or Delirious in church.
You have to be careful. You got to have a J-O-B in the 80s. You got to have some money. You can't get no pussy. Listen to the radio. That's what it's about. Listen to Madonna. I'm a material girl in a material world. You ain't got no money. You can't have no pussy.
How'd that go over?
Not well at all. But that's the thing. Like, I would try to figure out how to clean it up and make it my own. But that's when I learned. And from there, I was like, I could do this. And then the Arsenio Hall show would be on. I was like, I could do those monologues. And I started writing daily monologues. And then and then The Living Color was on. So I started doing characters. And then I started, you know, at like 12, 13, doing my research of finding out who Richard Pryor was and Red Fox and George Carlin. And these were people like, yo, this is something different. And then Def Comedy Jam came out. And I was like, I have to get on that stage one day. And that's where it all began. Like, I was like, and the thing is, because before then I was just wanting to be a musician. I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be a rapper. And my dad, who was preaching at the time, was like, yo, every kid in this neighborhood wants to do that. Do something different. I was like, all right, well, I want to be a comedian. And he's like, well, you are funny. He's like, so yeah, he would let me open up for him. And I became like the opening act for the preacher man.
So was that religious material?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus jokes. Shadrach, Meshach, and a big black Negro. That was, it was those type of jokes.
Oh, man. And so 15, 16, you start hanging out at the store, comedy store.
A comedy store birthday.
The Comedy Store is a long-running comedy club in West Hollywood. It was opened in 1972 by comedians Sammy Shore and Rudy DeLuca and taken over by Sammy's ex-wife Mitzi the following year. Among the club's alumni are almost every important name in comedy over the past five decades, including Rodney Dangerfield, Roseanne Barr, David Letterman, Robin Williams, Eddie Murphy, Gary Shandling, Whoopi Goldberg, and Jim Carrey. The new Showtime series I'm Dying Up Here, produced by Carrey, is a fictionalized version of the club's origins.
Yeah, man.
Were you the only kid there?
I was. I mean, there was a couple, like, it was like some gimmicky things where, like, certain comics would bring their kids and, you know, like, let them do some stuff here and there. But I was the only one that was really dedicated. I remember, like, at the Laugh Factory, they would do, like, these kids comedy camps for, like, 2 weeks in the summer. They would let kids do comedy. But I was already, like, I was doing the road by the time that stuff was going down. So I was out. Just like with everybody else, standing there working for my food five nights a week, hoping to get 2 minutes on the stage in the original room or the belly room or you know, over at the Improv. Like, I was working.
And what was your act like then?
It was about my life. It became about, like, cheating on tests, gas money, you know, smoking weed in school. Like, you know, it was like that type of stuff. Mm-hmm.
And were people laughing at the novelty or because you were
I think
funny,
it was more, I was cute. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I was more of a kid that was, I was adorable. Like, it wasn't that I was hilarious, but it's like, oh, I can't believe these things are coming out of this adorable kid's mouth. Like, it was very Macaulay Culkin.
And who was around at that time?
Everybody, man. Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock. Chris never really, like, embraced me. like, I always looked up to, like, those, like, Chappelle embraced
me. He was already a star at that point.
Yeah, yeah, he was a star. Yeah, yeah, Eddie Griffin. Like, but these, I would be backstage watching Joe Torre.
That's Joe Torre, the actor and comedian you've seen hosting Def Comedy Jam and in movies like House Party, not the Yankees manager.
Guy Torre, all of these guys who were, like, hot at the time. And I would just sit back in awe, you know, and really, you know, they would give me advice. Because like I said, Chris started really young. Chris Tucker started young. Chris Rock started young. Dave started really young. And they would give me advice of, you know, and they admired the fact that I was there at such a young age, really trying to get it done.
What's something they told you around that time that didn't set in till way later?
I remember Eddie Griffin told me, said, nigga, they gonna pay you. Like, I was like, what? What does that mean? But I get it. He was right. And then, I mean, Chappelle used to tell, he used to give me gems all the time. And he used to, you know, tell me about pushing myself. I didn't know what that was. Because I had a routine. Like, I wasn't a comedian. Like, I had bits. I had jokes, the exact same jokes that I would do every single night. And maybe I would do them a little differently, or I would mimic what I would see Chappelle do, or I would mimic what, you know, my favorite comics, I would, you know, borrow their banter with the audience. You know, if I ever got a heckler, I would say the same thing that one of them would say. Like, but I, you know, I didn't push myself, even though I thought, you know, every doing the same material five times a night was pushing myself. Like, no, you're not doing anything different. Like, you know, you're a kid that tells the jokes about, you know, gas money and, you know, CNCs and your mom's being cheap and, you know, and, you know, Frosted Flakes being ghetto. And, like, it was the same stuff. But, and, you know, I learned as I got older, like, oh, go up on stage without material. See how you can make it. Don't use any of your jokes.
So is that when you kind of started doing crowd work? Because even now, your specials are, you know, still like 30% crowd work.
Yeah.
Fresh, too. It's going down. You got to play in the front. I see you. See you looking like no Dale Beckham. I see you, bud.
I think the Improv and the man on the street stuff from even TV is what developed that. I would watch D.L. Hughley, Robin Harris, who inspired him, Joe Torre. These guys are the guys that would go out and do nothing but crowd work.
What's your last name with them thick ass glasses on? You could have watched yourself on Fayetteville, huh? Glasses that thick, I hope you ain't got no job when you supposed to see. Like, Lord, please don't be no school bus driver. You be running over the kids.
They would just, like, no material. They just would talk to the crowd and talk about the crowd. And I always admired that. And that kind of became my thing. It was like, all right, I'm gonna just talk to people in the audience. And being that quick-witted and being that fast with my banter, it's even to this day is one of the reasons why I host things the way that I do and can interact with people, because I kind of know how to bring out the fun moments and point things out.
If you look at the stuff you're doing on the Nick Cannon Show, and you look at the stuff you were doing on America's Got Talent, it's obviously the same person.
I want you to meet my friend Rachel.
I'm supposed to kiss the dog?
Well, yeah, does that work for you?
No.
yeah.
A lot of similarities.
Better
there.
Clothes.
Right, shinier suits. And
yeah.
Stuff. But it, I mean, do you, as that person, can you see those similarities? Or
100%. And I think you'll get an opportunity to see that person even more as I grow and develop. It's so crazy. Like, I see the trajectory of my career. even when others don't. So I know that guy is going to come back in my later years. Mm-hmm. And that's the guy that America loves and can relate to, is really likable. But that's an aspect. What the art, that's not the artist, though. The artist is the guy that can, you know, do super dramatic film roles, and, you know, the musician, and do, you know, introspective poetry. And, like, that's not the fun-loving guy who would dance with your baby for 15 minutes. You know, like, it's, but there's, you know, that's a side of me that, you know, there's the patriarch that knows how to, you know, handle children. And then there's the, you know, the guy who's more of an activist who's upset with the criminal justice system. Like, I'm not going to bring that guy on America's Got Talent. So it's just really being authentic, but understanding that there's layers to us.
Yeah. As someone who's done entertainment for kids and for adults,
yeah,
what do you think kind of operating in those worlds over the years has taught you?
I don't know. You know what's really fascinating to me? I'm probably the only person that can go to those extremes successfully, other than, like, maybe Bob Saget. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Right, whose whole thing is, like, he's the clean guy, but then, whoa, he does dirty jokes.
Yeah. Right. So, like, but, like, I, you know, to this day can host one of the rawest and edgiest hip-hop comedy shows, but then also, like, host, like, the wholesome philanthropic award show on Nickelodeon.
It's Thanksgiving weekend, get ready for Halo, a must-see concert event that celebrates the good that you do in your community.
You know, like, yeah, like I can, you know, have poems and songs with titles of bitches and, you know, fuck this and fuck that in my comedy specials, but then at the same time, like, I'm like the nicest dude that you want to see on America's Got Talent, or, you know, the Masked Singer, or, you know, the lip sync battle shorties. And it's like I fascinate myself sometimes, like, yo, I can't believe they must clearly don't know what I did last night. Like, if they allow me to do that this morning.
Right. But there is a model for that. It's just you have to go back 60 years to find it, right? The Sammy Davis Jr.'s, the Bob
Facts,
Hopes,
Bob
the Desi Arnaz.
Yeah.
Did you see that, like, well-rounded model coming up, or was it once you started doing everything you discovered that?
I did discover it later on, because, again, you got to remember, I was a kid from the projects who wanted to be Eddie Murphy, who wanted to be Tupac, who wanted to be, you know, like, these were the things that excited me at the time. So then when I got the opportunity, it was more in a wholesome environment. I was like, all right, I know I could do it, but I got to find out a way to, you know, walk this interesting line of being able to be true to myself, but still be able to be, you know, family friendly and, you know, middle America safe.
So 2003 comes along, Nickelodeon, you know, is on hiatus.
Yeah.
Done. You're making your album.
Yeah.
Was there pressure to make it basically a kid's album?
Yes, it was, man. And to this day, it's funny, man, because you got to remember, like, I came up with cats like Kanye, like Pharrell, even, like, Pharrell was definitely popping before, but I worked with Pharrell, you know, on even before the album.
Turned down two of his beats.
Yeah, and
it was. Is that true, by the way? I read that.
Yeah. I mean, this is the reason why. I remember Chris Lighty, God rest his soul, was my manager at the time.
Career of the late great Chris Lighty, who worked with everyone from A Tribe Called Quest to Diddy to Busta Rhymes to 50 Cent, check out the 2017 podcast series Mogul, hosted by Combat Jack and featuring many Cypher guests.
And he told me about these kids, the Neptunes, that he was working with, and Nori was working with them, and the Alcoholics, and then the thing, when he told me, he was like, yo, they just did this record on Jay-Z, I Just Want to Love You, like, it's crazy.
Know how to work your hips and your head's priceless. Confess your love to Hov and I never let you down. Get you bling like the Neptune sound. Okay.
And then they did, at the time they said he did Mystical Shake Your Ass.
Shake your ass. Watch yourself. Shake your ass. Show me what you're working with. Shake your ass. Watch
I was like, yes, I want those guys sound awesome. And so they flew me to Virginia, and me and Pharrell, we going to the movies, we hanging out with chicks, like, coolest dude ever. And he was, that's when they were like rock stars. Like, and I was like, these dudes are weird, but I like them. And you know, I'm with Chris Lighty. I'm Violator. I'm like, I'm thinking we about to make some edgy music. And for some reason, they got a mandate to make, you know, some soft stuff. And it's funny, like, there was a song, going back to this Will Smith thing again, it was a song called Your Pops Don't Like Me. Kind of like, you know, parents just don't understand.
Right. Yeah.
So, but in the concept, I had wanted to sample, I got the concept from LL Cool J song, Brenda's Got a Big Old Butt. Like, Brenda's got a big old butt. I know I told you I'd be true, but Brenda's got a big old butt, so I'm leaving you. So I had used that same more bounce instrumental that LL used, and I just was singing Your Pops Don't Like Me.
As Nick points out, both LL's track and his own sample Zapp and Rogers' 1980 hit, More Bounce to the Ounce.
But Brenda got a big old butt. I know I told you I'd be true, but Brenda got a big old butt, so I'm leaving you.
I can't stand him. Where did it come from? Tell me. I really don't like this dude.
No.
I won't so much.
Your pop don't like me.
It's actually, I think it's even a K-Solo song, if anybody can even remember that from back. Like, it's like, your mom's in my business. She's in my business.
Oh, yeah,
you
course.
Ain't your secret,
yeah,
your
same,
mom's.
That same cadence.
Your mom's in my business. She's in my business. Can't you see, girl, your mom is trying to end this. Your mom's in our business.
Yeah, so it's like, your pops don't like me. He don't like me. Don't you see, girl, your pops want to fight me. Your pops, right? Like, I was, that was the, over the Brenda's Got a Big Old Butt beat. So it was like, some, it was a hip-hop record, but still it was funny and friendly. And Pharrell was like, I rock with it. I love it. I love what you did with it. But Pharrell, for some reason, was like, yo, we got to make it Nickelodeon. And I was like, nah, like, I want to make it more hip hop. So he gave me this beat that had no kick drum in it. And, you know, like, the Neptunes are known for, like, crazy kick drums. So it was all like this Mandarin sounding like acoustic guitar with the, it had the Neptunes like side stick, like snare, which was cool, but it was just, it sounded like a commercial jingle, the beat. And I was like, ah, I don't like, I'm, and like, that's my man. So we cut it and everything. And like, he's working with like the Alcoholics in the next room. And I was like,
can I have that stuff?
Yeah,
please?
I was like, I want that, yo.
Don P, hell nah, that shit a waste of money. We drink that Cristal, Don P be tasting funny. You a liquid bunny, and I'm you Hef. After task, get the Mac, and y'all can have who's left.
And I remember it was, I mean, because Pusha T and Malice, all of them were there. And they, it was a beat that was the, for the clips that I don't think Pusha was feeling at the time. I was like, yo, let me get that. And he was like, you sure? I was like, yeah. And then Pharrell, and I still got there. I think I put it out on one of my mixtapes, but it was this song called Just Another Case.
Oh. Just another case of someone you don't want around. They don't really care. They just wanna hunt you down. Better look around.
And Pharrell was on the hook, and it was a Neptunes beat. And it was cold, and I was rapping, and it was like, I remember Pharrell did some ad-libs, like, knock him out the box, Nick. Like, it was like the Slick Rick, and it was like he gave me, like, the whole Slick Rick ad-libs and stuff, and it was fire. And I remember we turned it in, and they liked the Pops Don't Like Me record more than they liked the more hard stuff.
I was going to say, that one made the album.
Ultimately, because I hated the beat. Like, sorry, Pharrell. But yeah. I was like, I'm not.
So your version of it made the album.
Yeah. Well, kind of, because even again, like, they didn't believe in me. Like, I just wanted to, at the time, I was like, I just want to rap over LL Cool J's beat. So it was like, well, it has to be more modern. We have to do it. So they took the, like, me rapping over the beat that I had sampled on my MP, and they gave it to another producer, and they added all of this other stuff that wasn't the hip hop beat that I wanted.
Pops got hot, he was old school pimping, take tops, flip flops, and dress socks. Ran game when he came with the questions. Boy, you were young, and how you going for the Lexus? Sorry, Mr. Jack.
Which, it was cool, but I still wasn't happy with it. Like, and, you know, I still, you know, I got co-producer credit on it, but they used, like, one of the in-house Jive producers to kind of make it more poppy. Yeah. When I was like, no, leave it the way LL had it. Like, and you know, but then I got to put my man Petey Pablo on the hook, which I thought was kind of cool. Like, Petey came in and did his thing. So he switched the hook up because he gave it, I really don't like this dude.
I really don't like this dude.
Which was cool because Petey was hot at the time and he gave it a more like, it was funny and it ended up working. Like, I mean, it was a successful song for its time. So
you got on that record, we'll move on from it in a minute, but I have to comment that Just Blaze always makes great music.
Yeah.
But you got a Just Blaze beat during the year of PSA.
Yes.
You got a Just Blaze beat during the year of Pump It Up.
Yes.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Ho. H to the OV. I used to move snowflakes by the hook.
Just Blaze. Pump it up.
Bump it up, you came to get it drunk with a dame, but shit is drunk, you came to get it on.
Put it your body in a knot for me. More dimes in a party than a slot machine. Nah, we should be filling me in from filler with Hennessy. And now I'm finna see a freak Tennessee. Cause when they see me.
How on earth did that happen?
Just was my man. And again, I think during that album process, man, I worked with everybody. Diddy.
Crazy, amazingly, you forgave me. Turn around and say to me.
Diddy co-produced Nick's song Whenever You Need Me featuring Mary J. Blige.
Pharrell, R. Kelly.
I'm a gigolo, spending lots of dough. You can tell the way the wide body.
Just Kanye.
That Kanye song, was that the one that surfaced a couple years later?
Off that Patron, anything could happen. That's canceling Kanye that got you dancing. Had the whole block full of cops and ambulances. Why don't we keep our pockets fat like hammer pants?
I think that was the stuff me and Kanye were doing for my second album. Actually, when Kanye was starting Good Music, I was one of the artists. I was working, you know, it was early on. It was like me, John Legend, GLC. You know, like those consequence, like it was, you know, early Good Music.
Right. You said you were around some of the writing, like the,
yeah,
that
Gold Digger, Brand New.
Haters like when Shaq left the Lakers just to heat it up. I say the stats are stunt. I don't need the front. Make Black History a day. I don't need them all. The survey says by the streets of court.
It was just, we were making all of those records together, you know, the Can I Live record that I did, Kanye mixed it. We wrote on there together. He gave me some dope lines.
My case. It's the late 70s, huh? You 17, huh? And having me, that'll ruin everything, huh? It's a lot of angels waiting on their wings. You see me in your sleep, so you can't kill your dreams. $300, that's the price of living. What? Mommy, I don't like this clinic.
Yeah, so it was just, that's just that, the way Kanye works today, that's the way he works back then. He'd get a room full of creatives and interesting minds and the best songs come out. And it's a very smart and intelligent way to approach songwriting.
What did he do on that first record? Was it anything that ended up making the album?
Nah, it wasn't. It really wasn't. It was, and at the time, that was, Kanye was, you know, a beat maker at the time. So he gave me a bunch of beats that I wrote to and, you know, the stuff we did, or the beats he gave me, just my pen wasn't strong enough at that time to make the songs that were. And he was making his own bones, you know. This was during like Slow Jams and Through the Wire, so
he's keeping the best stuff for himself. At this
not
point.
Even that, but he was just like, he was, you know, I didn't believe him. I'm gonna be honest, like the stuff he would give me, like, yo, like it was competition almost. Like I was like, yo, I can make something just as hot as you, because to me, I consider myself a producer too. Like I produced, you know, a lot on my first album, and even before that I wanted to produce more, but you know, I was instructed by my A&R and my management that I had to work with all of these other people. So the way that came about just was, you know, at the time that camp, it was Just and Kanye, and at that time Just was hotter. You know, like and he had did Pump It Up, and I was like, yo, I want one of those Pump It Ups. And the crazy thing, I had a Just Blaze beat with Fat Man Scoop and the Ying Yang Twins on a song.
Yeah.
Like, that was like, Fat Man Scoop, if he was on your record at the time, it was in the club. The Ying Yang Twins were hot as fish grease. And their record started to pick up steam, but we, for whatever reason, the Ying Yang Twins label would not clear that song for a sample. So I clear that song for a single. So I couldn't put that out as my single. Again, there was I hated Your Pops Don't Like Me. I did not want that to be my first single. I wanted the song Just Did to be my first single. I was like, yo, look what Joe Budden did with Pump It Up. Like, I want that as my first single. And, you know, the Yin Yang Twins label wouldn't allow them to clear it. So,
I mean, it sounds like it was an enjoyable experience to make. But what I'm hearing a little bit is what listening now the record kind of sounds like, which is Nick Cannon's version of Song X, Nick Cannon's version of Song Y. And you're saying that was the management's idea of
They were like, and that's kind of what happens when you get, you know, when you're a young artist and a new artist. And you don't step in and put your foot down. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to be likable and follow the rules. And I wanted my manager to like me. I wanted my label to like me. So whatever you want me to do, I'll work hard. Right. And I didn't know that's not what it's about. It's like being an artist is sticking to your message, sticking to your sound, being comfortable with who you are and standing firm in that. And I didn't know how to do that at the time. I was just happy to have a record deal and happy to potentially be making money. And so that's how the album came out.
You said potentially.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of record contracts.
Yeah. And if you think about all the people that I just named at their peak, I had to pay all of those people.
Oh, wow. So, all of their rates at their height. Yeah.
Yeah. So Diddy, Mary J. Blige, Just Blaze, Yin Yang Twins, Fat Man Scoop, R. Kelly, Pharrell. Like that my budget was insane.
So after that,
I was in debt.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. After that, it's some years till you make another record, and it's an EDM record.
Me sexy. Me sexy. What do I hear? Me sexy. Me sexy. What do I hear? Me sexy.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and that's the crazy thing, because, and I'll just back up a little bit, because what happened was, again, I ran Nick Records for Jive, so I was also trying to sign artists and be, you know, and produce, and I was like, you know, Gigolo did what it did, but, you know, I wanted it to do more, so I was kind of unhappy at Jive. Still not being young, not knowing how these things work. Luckily, at the time, I had my manager, who's still my music manager to this day, Blue Williams, kind of was, you know, he's managing Outkast and CeeLo. Like, he was the guy. So he was able to finagle me off of Jive and get me another record label deal, and with my own label at Motown Universal. And then I was watching Kanye move. And I was like, I want to do what Kanye did with Good, but over here. And I was signing artists. And I wasn't really worried about being an artist myself. I was,
this would have been like 05, 06,
Yeah. And that was like, I did the Can I Live record, which was like, caught a lot of people's attention.
Yeah. I'm talking, Mom.
Can I Live is a song about Nick's mother's decision to walk away from a clinic minutes before she was supposed to have an abortion. While Nick subsequently said that he was not speaking out against abortion, the song and the video were shared and written about by anti-choice advocates and organizations.
And that's the one Kanye actually worked with me on. But I didn't, it was in between labels. So it was kind of a Jive record, but it was kind of a Motown record. And I wasn't really trying, like, my project was actually called Stages. And it was like the next stage in my life. And that's... But I never put it out. So I did a bunch of records with Kanye. I produced a bunch of the records, and I ended up shelving it myself because I was wanting to be more of a businessman and a CEO and develop artists, and not even understanding truly how to do that. It didn't go well. Like I was spending a bunch of my money, because I was making money in every other aspect, film, TV. So then people started looking like, oh, his music is more of a hobby. Like, he's successful over here, but for whatever reason, he's kind of toying around with this music. And even myself, that's what it kind of became for me. Like, it was an escape.
If enough people say that, right?
Yeah. I was like, oh, I guess this is kind of my hobby. Because I was making way more money than all my friends in the music industry and film and television. So I was like, yeah, all right, this is a cool hobby to have. And I thought it was kind of cool. It was like, yo, I get to do this for fun. And then I kept using that term for fun. And then so the next time I released a record, it truly was for fun and almost a comedic record. And I kind of put out White People Party Music as a, like, comedy parody type of, like.
I was going to ask, it's on this very interesting line of, yeah, like, you're making fun of it, but also, like, it's a pretty elaborate.
Yeah, it's like, it was good music. Like, Afrojack produced a lot of stuff.
Hold up in a Cadillac. Yeah, my old life mama, they can have it back. We tan up the club, can you handle that? With a beat like that from Afrojack, yeah, he the man.
You know, I probably had one of the only records with Future and the Migos on it together.
Get it popping in them pajama pants. Get it popping in them pajama pants.
You know, like, I don't know. Like, I was set out to do a parody album. Like, I was this character, Connor Smallnut. Right.
Like, in Whiteface.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Brock does not lose. Only thing that could cheer me up now, man, is some Jello shots and some beer pong.
All of that. And it was a joke, and it kind of was leading up to, I had a comedy special at the time called Fuck Nick Cannon. So I was like, yo, this is a cool way to kind of launch all of this content, released it independently. And again, I was like, high in sight. I was like, ooh, what I'd make, I would probably let everybody know that this is a comedy album. This isn't like me actually trying to make an EDM album. But I think over the years, like, I was always consistently DJing and making a name for myself in the music space. Everything I did, from Drumline to, you know, the TV shows, Wildin' Out, they were all music-inspired, driven, and inclusive. But for whatever reason, people still didn't see me as a musician. And maybe that was the way that I displayed it. And I didn't really care, because, again, I'm a kid from the projects. Like, I'm successful. like I'm happy. Like,
I'll say, with the view from this 40th story office here,
and that's the thing. Like, I was so focused on being, you know, the best entrepreneur, the best CEO, the chasing that bag, to have these sky rise views, that I forgot about the importance of being an artist. And that's kind of where I feel like I dabbled in it, I tapped in it, but even like now, I feel like I'm in this space where I understand how to define and distinguish and diversify the two worlds. And I can be an artist, but I can still be an entrepreneur. I can be an entertainer, but still stay true to what's really important to me.
There was one aspect of the White People Party Music phase,
right,
that was crazy.
Right.
Which was the videos, I think most of which you did with Dwayne Henry, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about Dwayne, because I looked at his resume. He was a cameraman.
Yeah.
So how'd you pluck him from all of the cameramen you've worked with, presumably over all the years?
Yeah, it's really, honestly, like, my vision and just having somebody execute and point and shoot. And, you know, I call these guys predators. I love them. Like, they're shooters, as in cameramen. They're producers, as in knowing how to work in the field, and they're also editors. So, like, when you can get somebody who can just do it all, they're great collaborators. I mean, I still have a few of those guys that have been in my office here to this day, that I can say, I'll write the treatment and say, hey, this is what we're going to do, and we'll go out and shoot it that night. And then we're in the edit, cutting it, you know, the next day. So those... Dwayne was one of those guys, just like hardworking, focused, and we would get to it, and we would make, like, each video was its own thing. It was, some of them were like comedy pieces, some of them were like elaborate music videos, some of them were, you know, I would do a Funny or Die, some of them I would do, you know, there's commercials for my headphones. But it was a real fun time for me. It was this opportunity to be as creative as I wanted it to be.
And it was maybe the most you've ever danced.
Yeah, well, cutting back to, you know, when I was, you know, running back and forth from San Diego to L.A. and trying to be a Soul Train dancer in between comedy sets.
From all those lessons at the Boys and Girls Club?
Yeah, exactly.
Nick took his first formal dance class at the Boys and Girls Club of East County. He is now a member of the organization's Alumni Hall of Fame.
It actually turned into something that I was really, really always wanted to do and kind of had that in me. I mean, even in the early days of my rap groups and stuff, we would throw parties. We were dancers. So to be able to do that was a lot of fun. I was just having fun on White People Party Music. Like, I was married. I had a bunch of money. Like, I was just wanting to just do something silly. And that's what I did. And it's funny because people took it so seriously because it was real music. And I was working with real guys. I had great records that Rodney Jerkins produced with me and Pitbull. Like,
she don't know. She's the only one.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Everybody in the world wants to meet her.
These are, you know, great songs, but I did it in a way because as a DJ, I was kind of like, all right, is this where everything's going? This whole four on the floor, like EDM. And I wasn't necessarily a fan of it. So I think the EDM community kind of got mad at me because they thought I was like, I was making fun of them.
Oh, they did. Yeah. I read some of the press over the past couple days. They definitely did.
Yeah. And then the hip hop community was like, what the hell is this shit? Like, you're supposed to be rapping. So it was like, I was making a joke, but I don't think anybody else was in on the joke but me.
Yeah. Tell me about creating Wildin' Out. How did you get the idea for improv, hip hop, whose line is it anyway, kind of thing?
Yeah.
And not just have the idea, but say, I'm going to spend low six figures.
Yeah.
Because no one else wants to make it.
Yeah. Luckily, you know, again, that same mentality of be my own self generator. Don't sit around and wait. And I was in the middle of doing a bunch of movies. I was, you know, Drumline was out and Love Don't Cost a Thing. And I was really like the it kid at the moment. You know, every year or two, there's the guy that like, ooh, we like him. He's new and shiny. And like, let's kind of give him every script there is out there. But at that time, I had started thinking like, yo, I'm going to write my own scripts. I'm going to produce my own movies as well as TV. And I had a background in TV. I had a relationship with MTV. So I would pitch them things and they just didn't get these concepts. I was like, you know what? I got to put my own money up. And I remember one day I was doing stand-up at the Comedy Union off of Pico, and Cat Williams was there. Kevin Hart was there. These are guys nobody knew. And then, you know, later on, it became like the D. Ray Davises, the Avion Crocketts. And he was like guys that I was my peers. We were coming up together. And I remember I forgot someone was like, yo, man, you got to do something to put us on. And I was like, of course, you know. And I looked up to the Keenan Ivory Wayans and the Jamie Foxes, the Eddie Murphys, and they would bring, once they got on, they would bring their crew and they would create stuff for them. So that's what I did. I created this show of pretty much what we do in a comedy club, like talk shit about each other, like and hang out. And I was like, I got it. I'm gonna infuse hip hop in a comedy club. And I had seen, like, when you think about Uptown Comedy Club that was filmed here in New York, like that Tracy Morgan and Jim Brewer and all of those guys kind of started on.
Hey, G, I know you and you ain't Von G. Well, your father is so dumb, he got a part-time job painting Skittles.
The Uptown Comedy Club was a show that aired on BET from 1982 to 1994. Among its writing staff and cast members were Tracy Morgan, Jim Brewer, and Paul Mooney. Musicians and groups like Brand Newbie and Das FX and Mary J. Blige also made appearances.
And I would see that stuff and be like, we don't have anything like that out on the West Coast. And, you know, we have famous clubs out there from, like I said, the Comedy Union, Maverick Flats, Comedy Act Theater. These are places in, you know, that some legends were born. And so I wanted to have that same experience. And then, of course, being a student of improv in high school and being a fan of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I wanted to give the hip hop version of that. And that's kind of how it all started in 2004.
And so now improv comedy is giant.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like the big schools are opening new locations every week and a half.
Yeah.
Taking over most of downtown
New York
City.
I want in on that business. I want the Wildin' Out improv schools.
Well,
it's coming.
This is what I'm asking. Do you take any kind of credit for that since you have a generation of people kind of grew up seeing at least a version of improv on Wildin' Out?
I would love it. I mean, I even coined the phrase freestyle comedy. You know, I feel like that's really what it is. I mean, because when you think about freestyle rapping and improv comedy, they're the same thing. You're using the same mechanisms in your brain to be quick-witted in on the spot and control the room and confident. Like, that's, they're very similar in those states, and the same rules apply, you know, the plus one, adding on, never giving up, never retreating, you know, and knowing how to be so quick. I think we've fine-tuned the what it means to be an improv comic, and those skill sets of being a great freestyler or a battle rapper, and kind of put it all on his feet. So I know we've inspired a generation. I mean, it's kind of cool to see young guys like Chance the Rapper say Wildin' Out is his favorite show.
I saw that in the, yeah, in the last episode. He said you guys were foundational for him, I think was the word he used.
What do you want to say to the people at home, Chance?
Man, number one, Black Lives Matter. Number two, this show is institutional and foundational for me and my growth, so I appreciate you, all Black creatives, and everybody that got their own space.
Yeah. And to be able to be like, man, that's what I set out to do, and to be able to see it come full circle is outstanding.
So how do you guys at the show teach the battle rappers in your cast how to be funny, and how do you teach the comedians how to battle rap?
I think it's the same mechanism, you know what I mean? Like, they just got to realize they have it in them. I remember, like, Hitman Holler was a dude who was just strictly angry battle rapping. But I was like, yo, man, you got the charisma. Like you make people laugh at your battles. Like, those are, they're called punchlines in battles for a reason. Like, they spark a reaction. So, and then the same thing with funny people. Like, they think quickly on their feet. So now you got to do, like, you know how to rhyme. Now you got to do is keep the rhythm and you'll be fine, you know. So it's not, it's, you know, we have these workshops that we do kind of for the newbies. And you watch them see the process, because in their mind, like, oh, I don't rap. Or rappers be like, nah, man, I don't do that funny stuff. But then you watch them work with each other, and then it's magic.
Interesting. And do you notice when you have guests on there, you know, who are not cast members, the right, musical performers, if, when they are on the bits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you notice a difference between the people like a Chance or a Vic Mensa who, you know, at least when they were coming up, freestyle rap consistently, and yeah, artists who either didn't or maybe have been successful long enough that they don't have to anymore?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. There's several people who won't come on the show because they're like, man, I don't do that freestyle stuff. I was like, man, you don't have to. Like, but they're frightened of it, or it's almost the idea that they don't want to be exposed, because there's this idea that if you can't do that, then you're not a real rapper,
mm-hmm,
which I don't believe. I mean, like, I feel like, you know,
I mean, one thing I've learned, I studied that and talked to, you know, all the West Coast freestylers, yeah, and all that. And it is almost an entirely different thing to be able to do what a Micah 9 or an ESG does.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a skill set.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, you look at it as hip hop is jazz. There's some people who can really are amazing on the saxophone with freestyling and improvising and knowing how to weave their way and play off of, you know, the pianist and the drummer extremely well. Then there's some jazz musicians that are very by the book and play their song the exact same way every time. And that's what they measure themselves on. Like, they don't want a note to be off. But to be able to call both of those things jazz is the same thing what we call rap. There's some people who are just great songwriters or great deliverers of other people's songs. And then there's people who are freestylers who can just, you give them a word and they're going to go. And to me, I value the both, you know, and the gentlemen and ladies who can do both are exceptional.
And often very good on your show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're more, it's all a confidence and comfort thing, you know. And it's funny, you find the people who are not rappers at all more willing to play, or the people who are not comedians at all more willing to play, or the people who are super confident rappers like the Chance the Rappers, the Kanye West, the T.I.s.
My n***a rocking him some barrettes. Why the hairstyle? I know you got some regrets. Got on some glasses, can't you see? You know you only wear them bitches when you read. Little ass beard, your little ass weird.
What's Indian I- girls, but I won't hurry. Last time we boned, you had the bedroom smelling like curry. Come on, dawg, you supposed to be the pimpin' prince. I seen you in Friday After Next, and I ain't seen you since.
Adults only, this ain't for the kids. I'm perfect and private and publicly. Would you love a real could Nick Cannon be on some other
Like, those are guys that are just coming and be like, man, whatever, make fun of me, say what you want to say, and I'm going to try this freestyle thing. I might not be the best at it, but I'm going to give it to you. And then you got the guys at Vic Mensa, like, that just murder it.
Okay, you buried yourself. You should have brought your own shovel ever since Mariah found a nigga on her own level. I don't mean to go back and bring up your divorce, but how that work? Do she pay you child support? Now you think you
styling. So there's Nick Cannon, the producer,
right,
dancer, musician. TV host, children's book author. We have not yet covered, and I haven't heard you much talk about Nick Cannon, the talent scout, which is where maybe you've had some of your biggest successes.
Yeah.
So how do you spot a Kalani, a Pete Davidson?
Yeah.
Like, is there something that jumps out at you?
And I'm trying not to cry because he's everything to me. This is my guardian angel, you guys. First of all, can we have a round of applause for this man?
Nick Essel here played a huge part in Kalani's career. As for Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson, a 15-year-old Davidson called into Nick's radio show and impressed Nick so much that he subsequently took Davidson out on the road. The future SNL cast member also had an early appearance on Wild and Out back in 2013.
Yeah, Drive. I mean, obviously, I've been around probably every talented person in America.
Sure. Right, right. At one point or another in their career.
Yeah,
certainly.
Some point in my life, whether I was hosting them on a talent show, or I was backstage with them, or as a Nickelodeon, like, I feel like I have an eye for talent. But talent does not matter to me. The thing that matters to me is your drive, your gumption, your integrity, your perseverance, willing not to give up when people have told you, no, you're not going to make it. Or overcoming adversities in a way where, you know, whether it's your personal life, whether it's your business life, those are the people I feel like have such dynamic spirits that they will prevail regardless. And I feel like I'm drawn to those type of spirits.
Wow. And what was it about Kalani specifically? I mean, that you know, you did so much for her that she obviously is still grateful for. You know, she's very public about how you know, helped her move to Los Angeles, helped her get set up, find a home.
Yeah.
Like the video said, I was around in Oakland couch hopping and doing my thing. And he literally called me and said, yo, if you finish high school, I will bring you to Los Angeles and let you work in my studio. And I will give you an apartment so that you can have somewhere to lay your head for the first time in years.
I want to see her win and continue to win. She's a beautiful spirit. But at the time, she was a little girl. You know, and I remember I first met her on America's Got Talent. She was this like little chubby cheek, weird colored hair, little girl. But her tone was crazy. And then the fact that the way she carried herself, you know, the whole scenario on America's Got Talent, she was probably one of the most professional young people that, or people in general that I've ever met. And I remember getting a call. It was like New Year's. I was in Australia and somebody called me. Interestingly enough, it was a father of the artist, her.
Mm. Another person you've had.
Yeah, who I signed her when she was 9 years old.
Yeah.
But, you know, and Kehlani and you know, her from the same area in Northern California. They also came up, like, with Zendaya. Like, it's just a bunch of talented young women, you know, from Northern California. But I just wanted to help. You know, I got this call. And that, you know, the girl who is on AGT isn't doing so well and that she's homeless and kind of, you know, just trying to find her way. And I was like, yo, we got to go get her. And, you know, kind of personally went out and figured out how to get her and told her, like, yo, in three years time, you're going to be a star. 3 years later, she was nominated for a Grammy.
We're running very low on time, getting the nod here. But I wanted to ask about Calling All Models.
Yeah.
Some of the best singing and most adventurous singing you've done is on that project. Tell me about that.
Celebrations with the guys I sacrificed, 'cause I knew you could not sleep without it. Meanwhile, I love
you. Know what? I'm going to share this with you.
Yeah.
Everything I do is calculated. So I think on this podcast, I kind of probably talked quite a bit about the lessons that I've learned specifically in music. You know, some would call them, you know, not triumphs. I don't want to call them failures. I call them lessons because I felt like I had the opportunity to get a close up view of how the music industry works and never really got an opportunity to be an artist. So much so that when I sign artists myself, I say, just be yourself, be an artist. I don't want to be involved in what songs you pick. I don't want to be involved in any of that. I just want to be a conduit. I want to be a magnifying glass. I want to be a loudspeaker for your passion in art. And I've had the opportunity recently to be that for myself. And because I am so successful in many other aspects, now I get to make the music that I want to make. But I also know, as an entrepreneur and a marketer that I am, there's a way to get into the marketplace to be received well. Like, even everything that I do on Wildin' Out is calculated. The fact that I let everyone make fun of my music.
Okay, that was fresh and old. But let me tell you something about Big Snoop Dogg. I can look so fresh and so clean and so sack. But let me tell you about your rap, it's straight whack.
And say all of the things that the critics say. And I purposely do that in a way to where I want everybody like, man, his music's not that bad. He's actually really talented. Oh, they go so hard on him. So, and it's also a journey. And I learned this from Prince. When Prince created the time, or Prince would use Star, is it Star Child that he used? Or something Star, what was the name? He used a alias when he would produce for other people.
Early in his career, Prince would use the pseudonyms Jamie Starr or The Starr Company on production and engineering work for himself and other artists.
And I did the same thing and continue to do the same thing.
Can you let the cat out of the bag on that?
There's still some that I don't want to, you know. But, you know, honestly, like, I worked on a lot of Mariah stuff that I would never say, because I didn't want people to be like, oh, her husband's writing and producing songs for her. But learned so much from her in that songwriting process, and we worked on some hits together. Mm-hmm. And even some younger artists and you know, that I, those ways of kind of, I don't say ghostwriting, but having the opportunity to produce for some pretty big artists, but doing it as an alias. I remember I was in the studio with Jay-Z one time, and I had this beat that I sampled the Newsies. He's the king of New York.
I'm the king of New York.
And I was like, yo, this is a perfect record for Jay-Z. And he was fresh off of Hard Knock Life. And he told me to my face, like, the beat is fire. I cannot rap over a beat produced by Nick Cannon. I was like, well, at least you're being honest. And from that day, I was like, you know what? I'm going to come up with a producer alias. And produce under the alias. And in that same way, the where Prince created the time, and even in Purple Rain, they like made fun of him and made fun of his clothing and called him sissy and all of this
in
stuff.
In his movie.
Yeah.
How's the family?
But he wrote all the music.
Yeah.
You know, even their music. And I was like, yo, I write all of the music on Wildin' Out. I make all of the beats, you know, all of the theme songs. Every joke that you hear somebody say about my music, I probably wrote it. Like, I probably was in on it, you know, unless it's like, you know, one of the battle rappers or something like that. But even then, I give them permission to say whatever you want to say, because then that shows, one, that I don't take myself seriously, but also shows the confidence and the security that I have in my ability, that I let people say whatever they want. So in making something like Calling All Models, before that I made, you know, the gospel Ike Turner, My Side of the Story. And like all of these things where these were real intimate, close projects. And on like Ike Turner, I dabbled in the singing, but it was more rap.
And it got a little kick to it. I don't drink, but my chicks do it. Fucked up, let's get to it. On perp like I meant to do it.
Calling All Models, I sang a little bit. I still, the world still hasn't seen my true voice and how my ability to sing. But if I just came out one day and I started singing like Tyrese or Trey Songz or Like, then they'd be like, yo, what are you doing now? Like, so I feel like I have to.
You give them a frozen calls or something first.
Exactly.
The sun will be shining. Flowers still will bloom and the leaves will turn again. But time will be frozen for us.
Something where it's easy to digest, but I have a studio full of records that you would have no idea that it was me, you know, or like even the ability, but I know I have to strategically put that stuff out there. So what Calling All Models was for me was really a mixtape that was kind of like a placeholder or an appetizer of the songs to come. For model music. It's like, that's why it's called the prequel, because model music is more of my Quincy Jones, Dr. Dre compilation project of all the artists that are signed to me, all the artists that I rock with that will be out. But I was like, yo, let me give them something of just an intimate R&B. Like, this is how I'm feeling. I'm in my feelings. I'm having relationship and female problems. Boom, here you go. And hopefully you'll get to see, you know, more of that.
One or two quick final things, yeah. Very quick.
I'm having fun. So
good.
She knows when I'm having fun.
Yeah. The stand-up bit you did a couple years ago, maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The I'm racist one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was strange.
Yeah.
Even as someone who, you know, had listened to a lot of your stuff.
Yeah.
I don't really think there are any jokes in there. It was just kind of a list of stereotypes.
Yes, I prejudge people. I do. If I meet somebody from India, I assume they house smell like curry. And it's a golden ball somewhere. Yes, I'm racist.
Like, yeah.
What was that? Do you have mixed feelings about it now?
No. I think that was definitely me. And even, I think it was before its time, but it was me holding the mirror up to society to where we are today. This was pre-Trump. But this was like, admit it. Say what you want. Like, I like my racism served to my face. You know what I mean? And now with if you really dig deep into what I was saying, I was like, and I truly believe that, like, a subjugated group of people such as Black people truly can't be racist. They can be prejudiced. They can prejudge. We can make stereotypes. But when you think of race, with racism comes power over, you know, a dominating another group. That is beneath you in to society's terms. So I was kind of flipping it on its head, but at the same time, I was embracing the stereotypes that we all make. I was saying, be honest with yourselves. We are a stereotypical prejudging society. That's what it's built off of. When you think about what Wildin' Out is, every joke is a joke that's a stereotype that we throw on its head. And there's nothing wrong with that. So when I made that bit, it was saying, like, stop hiding it. Stop pretending like racism doesn't exist, because it does. And I did it early on, you know what I mean? And I think people can embrace it now, and it's funny, and that stuff, you know, got a lot of attention. I mean, that special was called Fuck Nick Cannon, in the sense it was like, yo, I'm saying all the things that I hear on social media said about me. I'm getting in your face to say I'm dressing up in, as they call it, white face to show people, like, yo, these are things that need to be discussed. And it's interesting, because they're definitely being discussed now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, just to stay on that for 1 minute, there's no objection in the bit. You're just saying kind of, these are a bunch of stereotypes, not like I am, you know, you don't make explicit, I am holding up a mirror. It's kind of like, I think these things.
Yeah. And I think at that time, I think it's all in the delivery. I think that goes even back to, if you want to say, the Bob Saget of it all, of, hey, this is the cute kid that I know from America's Got Talent, like, blatantly coming out and saying he prejudges and makes these stereotypical assumptions about groups of people, all in jest. You know what I mean? Like clearly, like, and it was more like, hey, I'm just like you. And then ultimately, when we get to the end of the bit, and that's funny because I would do it differently every single night, so I can't even remember how
what
I did on this,
the special.
But ultimately, I would go and say all of this stereotypical racist type of stuff, and then I would, at the end of the night, I would talk about an experience that I had doing stand up down south.
Where it ends with the Elvis impersonation.
But that was even from one of my earlier pieces. But what that ended up being would be how I would end up hugging a white guy in the audience.
I done kissed the old white lady on the mouth on TV. She put some tongue in there too, girl. I see what you're talking about, Trish.
You know, every night and saying like, yo, racism, like there's only one race, and that's the human race. And the fact that we have been brainwashed for centuries that we need to divide and we need to compartmentalize each other based off of skin tone and color differences and melanin and instead of embracing the differences, we separate ourselves. That was the message. And it may not have been right in that joke, but it was ultimately in the joke of this whole idea. The special was called Fuck Nick Cannon. It's like everything, like, yo, people have said so many negative things about me. I'm going to throw all of that back. And then the last bit was really about, like, I'm going to be myself. I hear what you're saying, but I hear you calling me corny. I hear you saying I'm this. I hear you say, but you know what? I'm going to do it my way and the way that I want to do it and drop the mic and whirl off.
She's like, man, is that what people think about me? Then I was like, you know what? Damn right I'm corny. I'm corny. Standing up for all the corny people in the world. We corny people unite. It's a cornucopia.
And so finally, what million things do you have going on right now?
Oh, man. What don't I have going on? I mean, you know, the Wildin' Out brand has expanded into touring. We're selling out arenas each and every night all over the world, really. I mean, we were in Toronto last night. And to be able to have a brand that I created for me and my friends now, to be able to be feeding, you know, thousands, to be able to be performing for millions. And now we have restaurants. I opened my first Wildin' Out restaurant on South Beach, and the next one's going to be in my hometown of San Diego. Just diversifying the brand in so many different ways. That I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about, you know, my next stage in life in academia. I mean, to be able to be now enrolled in college.
Still on the art?
Yeah. I'm still doing my thing at Howard University. Yeah.
In August 2016, Nick enrolled as a freshman at Howard University.
Dude, making it HU, you know, we on the yard heavy. to be able to hopefully one day be a professor. But I mean, currently still producing, starring, writing, directing, film, TV, music, all of that. That's kind of like one job for me. Like, entertainment will never stop. But I think these new plateaus of entrepreneurship, owning IPs and investing in real estate and being angel investors in Silicon Valley, like all of these things that are kind of...
You've been a consumer electronics guy for years now.
Yeah. Since 2010, you know, incredible. The consumer electronics company has been extremely successful, over $150 million in sales, and, you know, continuing to grow, continuing to learn that, but ultimately just trying to be incredible.
Awesome. It sounds like a great place to end. Nick Cannon, thanks so much for coming on Cypher.
Thanks.
When the possibility was first raised of having Nick Cannon on the show, I, like you, thought it was a little odd. He raps sometimes, sure, but isn't he primarily a comedian? But what I learned in preparing for the interview, and in talking to Nick, is that he's a hip-hop guy through and through. In fact, it's hip-hop's tenets of being ready for any situation, of improvisation, of taking unexpected elements and combining them, and of staying true to yourself in all circumstances that have marked Nick Cannon's career from the beginning. Plus, this interview gives us a rare chance to look at not only Nick's successes, but also some things that went wrong when it comes to his music career. But after some missteps and misunderstandings, it seems like Nick Cannon, the rapper and singer, is finally where he wants to be. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be Kay Salam, the producer and DJ who you were briefly introduced to during episode 241 at Soundset, gives us the whole rundown on his career, from being at Rhymesayers during the beginning of the label's rise, to making beats for your favorite rap, reggae, and dancehall artists, to hearing his music at the Olympics. Plus, you'll find out how diehard Nirvana fans reacted when he and his production partner Beatnik decided to remix Smells Like Teen Spirit. As I said at the beginning, The best way to keep The Cypher going is to give us some cash at patreon.com/thecyphershow. After you're done with that, go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. That's what helps keep us doing the show. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Cypher Show. And don't forget, more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Sasha Baron Cohen stuff.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I don't want to be involved in what songs you pick.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
And I did the same thing.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
But I never put it out.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Predators. I love them.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Daniel David.
One of the rawest and edgiest.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I keep a piano, a guitar, and turntables with me everywhere I go.
Got to.
Yeah. Stop unplugging my damn piano.
Yeah, they always do that. And I come in and turn on, like, what the hell is going on?